From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, celebrated hip-hop performance artist Mark Bamuthi Joseph joins Forum as part of our first-person series profiling the leaders, innovators, and other compelling characters who make the Bay Area unique. A National Poetry Slam champion, Bamuthi Joseph is artistic director of San Francisco-based Youth Speaks, and his current production, Red, Black, and Green, a blues blends poetry, dance, music, and film in an exploration of race and environmentalism. He'll be with us in studio. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of our Forum program. Celebrated hip-hop performance artist Mark Bamuthi Joseph joins Forum as part of our first-person series profiling the leaders, innovators, and other compelling characters who make the Bay Area so unique. In 1999, along with Team San Francisco, he won the National Poetry Slam Championship and was three-time San Francisco Grand Slam champion. A New York City native, he describes himself as a writer who moves, an educator who performs, and decidedly a member of the hip-hop generation. He serves as artistic director of San Francisco-based Youth Speaks and is presently performing in a production, Red, Black, and Green, a blues blends poetry, dance, music, and film in an exploration of race and environmentalism. Mark Bamuthi Joseph joins us for the second hour. And Bamuthi, good to have you back.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So well, thankful to be here.
I'm thankful to have you here. I'm thinking, oh, where does he see himself? mentor, educator, multimedia performer, poetry slam champion, griot, that is African storyteller. All of them really intersect, don't they?
Yes. You know, I'm a champion or proponent of hybridity. I don't know if that's a, you know, generational thing. I think that it's certainly an aesthetic manifestation just coming of hip hop culture, kind of the blending of styles. And I would say that hip hop culture is really the umbrella behind everything that I do. The advanced attack on urban oral literacy and how that permeates my parenting, my cooking, my everything.
Well, in fact, you worked with Jeff Chang, who's been a guest on this program, who kind of wrote one of the definitive histories of hip-hop.
Absolutely. I was actually just down at Stanford yesterday with the Institute of Diversity in the Arts on Jeff's invitation. And his book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, inspired my last piece, The Breaks, at least in form. But what I really love about my relationship with Jeff is that it, you know, extends beyond the academic. His son is on Spokes, which is the youth advisory board of Youth Speaks. And his son also plays baseball with one of my very good friends, Obasi Davis, on the Berkeley High baseball team. So, you know, so we cut deep into academia and the way urban culture kind of cuts through it all. But we're also friends and family.
In fact, your son Mackay, excuse me, I can't believe he's 9 years old already.
Yeah, telling me.
in your new production, you have something directed toward him that has to do with Tupac.
Yeah.
It also has to do with the Black Panthers, but you're really trying to sort of pass on that torch, that legacy?
Yeah, you know, the piece is based on the process of producing these festivals around the country, and the festival is called Life is Living. And the foundation or the bedrock of the festival really is to engage under-resourced communities in conversations around environment through the value of life. And while
so that was a lot of interviewing, in fact.
Yes. Yeah. And so while the production of these festivals has happened in Chicago and in Harlem and in Houston, the festival that happens here in the Bay Area in Oakland happens at Defermery Park, which is named for an 18th century Dutch trader, but has been rechristened colloquially and locally as Little Bobby Hutton Park after the first member of the Black Panther Party. And so the last section...
And famous barbecue chef and...
yes, that too. And yeah, so the last section of the piece is about that park and the legacy in Oakland of Afeni Shakur, who is Tupac's mom, her link to the Black Panthers, and Mackay growing up essentially two blocks away from this park in West Oakland, and the conversation of legacy that moves through the Black Panthers, through Tupac Shakur, and through my 9-year-old.
It's a legacy that goes back to the blues, too. I mean, this new production of yours. And I kept thinking about just how much Romaine Bearden and August Wilson, the influence of the blues has been pervasive in black artists, as it has been in your work.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the long history of Africans in America is made manifest through improvisation and innovation. You know, I refer to it as the jazz gene, that which enables us to make food without breaking ground, that which, you know, lands as kind of the air under the wings of, you know, of Michael Jordan taking flight, you know. So out of rampant unemployment, out of slave labor, out of harsh conditions, we bear fruit. And, you know, that is made manifest through music, certainly, but it is also made manifest through the body. And I think that's the thing that I connect to most relevantly and most urgently is this jazz gene as affected and manifested through my body.
It's also stories, though. And this new production is a lot of stories. Right?
For sure. You know, the piece is a survey, basically, of environmentalism throughout African America, visiting a southern city, a midwestern city, an east coast city, and here in Oakland, a west coast city. And, you know, where we started was kind of a top down, fairly presumptuous, middle class perspective on black folk and environment. Where we started was if we impose a value or if we impose an ideal and land it in an under-resourced park through osmosis, you know, the kind of surrounding perimeter of that park would be impacted in a way that jibed in a corollary way with what the green sector calls, you know, green consciousness or, you know, environmental consciousness. That's where we started. But where we ended, I think, is a little bit of a more humble posture, which is that, you know, black folk have been behaving in environmental ways for centuries. I don't have to tell Africans in America how to sustain themselves. You know what I mean? And, you know, what history calls to bear is that we've been doing a pretty good job. And so rather than moving backwards and or, you know, or moving from a kind of a top down perspective and saying this is what we should do, we instead landed in a place where we document what is already being done. And I think it makes for a much more textured, much more emotional, performative experience, as well as a better learning and growing experience for all the collaborators involved.
I'm going to lean on you to give us a little sample of that. We're talking, by the way, with Mark Barmoody Joseph, who is the poet and dancer and artistic director with Youth Speaks. And he is a poet and dancer and also artistic director of Youth Speaks. And their production, which is playing through the 22nd of October at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, is Red, Black, and Green, and known as A Blues. And before we get a sample of this, I saw some of the video of the production, and what I was struck by, well, I saw a few videos I want to talk with you about.
Okay.
But, what I was struck by, though, right away what grabs you is the setting. Talk about that, could you?
Well,
which is set up in the setting, so to speak.
Sure. Well, the set is constructed by and designed by an urban planner, an intentional community designer named Theaster Gates. Theaster is a genius. He lives and works on the south side of Chicago, but his work was featured in the Whitney Biennial last year. It'll be in the Documenta exhibit in Berlin next year, Seattle Art Museum, Milwaukee Art Museum, really all over. And Theaster begins with a really beautiful premise, which is that rather than exporting resources out of poor urban communities, you know, he just asks, what happens if you stay? You know, what happens if you make a little bit more money, but you keep your resources in your community? And how do you, you know, what also happens if you extend that ethos to design? So he constructs works out of salvaged materials that serve as brick and mortar ethnographies of neighborhoods, and transplants these materials to, you know, museum settings all over the place. So he's made four such structures. And the structures represent the four major cities that we produce Life is Living in. So there's a building for Chicago, one for Houston, one for Harlem, one for Oakland. And the structures are also color-coded. So there's a red building for Chicago, a black building for Houston, a green building for New York, and a blue building for Oakland. And the pieces come together to form a shotgun house. I was really inspired by places like Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, places that have really robust performing arts seasons and also really incredible visual arts catalogs and exhibition series. And so I've always been struck by what happens when you go into a visual arts setting and there's a performer just kind of slinking against a wall or kind of, you know, performing kind of this dissonant, atonal, and passing it off as, you know, as visual art. You know, I always wanted to kind of subvert that relationship, subvert that paradigm, and place the visual art sensibility inside of a performance space. So the set that Theaster has built is a standalone installation. And as audience members come into the theater, rather than take their seats, they come directly to the stage, and the first half hour of the performance is actually performed inside of the visual arts installation. So there's a gallery.
You're kind of breaking down the third wall there, aren't you?
You know, again, I think this is derivative of so many of my cultural influences, but primarily, you know, the proximity, the intimacy that I think works best in a classroom situation or in a conversation or any good relationship involves a certain level of emotional access, you know? And so rather than deal with the artifice of a performed fiction solely, I also wanted to create safe space, which is in keeping with our mission at Youth Speaks, for folks to engage the art in a new kind of way.
It's also a mission. I remember when I interviewed you years ago and you were talking back then even about cultural shift, you know, the cultural shift back to the tradition, but also forward, innovative.
Yeah, you know, we believe in future folklore, you know, and part of what that means is using the body and using just kind of a more analog ethic to move us forward into a technologically advanced and codified age, and just kind of bringing all those techniques together and all those ethics together inside of one space. I believe so. You know, I don't really believe in dichotomies and I don't believe in monoliths. I love the messy in between. I think that's what makes the work.
You love the word hybrid, in fact. It's sort of you've had the hybrid project and you've mentioned hybridization when you came on here, and there's all that sense of what you do as being, well, I remember a video that I saw of your work where you said, well, I've been sent to all these places. I mean, you've been to France, Senegal, China, Japan, because, and it was interesting because it was a kind of almost postmodern self-mock. You were saying, you know, I've convinced these people that I'm somewhere between high art and hip-hop.
Yeah.
And they were, don't tell anybody that I'm self-aware of this con game, which isn't really a con game, of course. It's too bad people can't see your movement here on the air, but you're going to give us maybe a little sample of the new show. Yeah?
Sure.
Set it up for us, please.
This comes from the process of doing Life is Living in Chicago, and hopefully this comes from the first section of the piece, and hopefully it's self-evident and will give listeners a sense of kind of the depth of the work that we're in and the depth of the mess that we're in. I meet her in Chicago. She offers me watermelon. And I hear this guy singing, hear him moaning out molecules to river his mother's spirit down like rapids raging, like injustice. And I know she's not from this country because New World blacks always give each other a secret absolution handshake before we offer each other watermelon. Sudan, she says. And I'm awash in the iTunes ubiquity of the word Darfur, which I know George Clooney and Madonna really care about, and I know Lost Boys and genocide, but I don't know why they're lost, and I don't know who's killing who. A Starbucks activist, I know what I read between the door and my dirty soy chai, but I do know that I found a clue in the shaking voice of a mother tongue, just now loosened in the still dark shadow of the loss of her son. Inner city school kid, life violently left invalid, gun blast, book bag, blood-soaked, Chicago, morning. Me and my do-gooder friends are greening the ghetto. I ask a mother about environment. She responds in the language of disaster, the culture of hazard, summer climax of climate, 36 school kids gun blasted to the hereafter. Her son was a witness that got dealt with before he could even think to snitch. She spits out a seed, looks at me, asks the question. I ask a mother about environment. She tells me of guns, of emotionally disabled boys whose green movement consists of recycling the sorry narrative of black on black crime. If you brown, you can't go green until you hold a respect for black life. She spits out a seed like a wasted leaf of a tree never grown, looks at me, asks the question. She shows me his picture, and if you look real close, you can see he has 21... I don't know, maybe 27 and a half hairs on his chin. At first you miss the hair because the first thing you notice is his skin. If it were soil, his is the earth brown you'd want to sow in. A Chicago son, hard times. He does not blink. So think of this brother brown. Now see this mother black. Do you see how dark the day becomes when you bury the sun? How you set the future back? A mother inters a murdered teen.
And that was a mother in Chicago whom you spoke to on this tour, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, no conflating, no fictionalization, straight out of the authenticity of the experience.
Yes. And, you know, when we started in Chicago, again, we thought we were going to do this eco festival at Clarendon Park in on the north side. And what we were faced with was the reality that in the previous school year, there'd been 36 kids murdered. And so it was a little difficult to talk just solely about green when the urban reality was much more kind of urgent and close. And this woman came to the festival specifically to talk about the passing of her son and, you know, brought a picture in the frame. And what she told me that, you know, really stuck was that coming from Sudan, you know, she'd left the worst kind of genocidal conflict certainly in the recent history, if not in the history of the continent. And she left Sudan and came to Chicago, and her son wasn't killed there. Her son was killed here in the United States in Chicago. And I think that's the foundation and the inspiration for the direction that we went in from that point forward, that it was important to highlight these stories as reflections of ways that we needed to turn our attention more towards valuing life than just green.
So does environmentalism take a back seat then? Is that really what you're implying?
No, what I'm saying is that they it must coexist on the same continuum and not in isolation or in ignorance of one another. You know, what I've learned principally, Michael, is that you know, environmentalism is so often associated with the Arctic or polar bears or with things, with actions, with composting, with recycling, with solar panels, and not enough around people.
Well, when we talk about racial injustice, we often talk about environmental bigotry and, you know, the places in the urban nightmare that people live that have not really taken out toxic waste dumps or have not mm-hmm. done the kind of jobs that need to be in Native American places where mm-hmm. they just put nuclear stuff and all of that, you know, is all a part of a picture of racial injustice, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's part of the picture, but it's not personalized. So we can talk about big ticket items or concepts and there are, you know, a slew of statistics that, you know, that support you know, that story or that trajectory, but kind of the
you want to personalize this.
Yeah, absolutely. The smaller truths, I think, that are a little bit closer to the heart are the things that we wanted to make more evident with this piece.
But we should mention that this is, that was a wonderful sample, and you delivered it beautifully, as is your wont, but you've also got dance, you've got music, you've got singing. I mean, you've got just that whole range again of multimedia, which you do.
Yeah, but I also have to give it up to my collaborators, because Theaster, beyond being a genius designer, sings like nobody's business. He manages to touch these crazy frequencies. It's like there's a direct connection between the sound of his voice and the crying game that's operating in anybody's heart, And Tracy Tolmere is an incredible actress and dancer in the piece. And Tommy Shepard makes music and acts like nobody's business. And then the director Michael Garces and the video designer David Slaza, the choreographer Stacey Prince. It's really
a big production.
Yeah. It's a big production. It's a big deal, but worthwhile, I believe.
And you've got just things sort of resonating in my head. Spending time with a slam artist like you and a slam champion, really. She will be my rock, and I will be her sword and shield. And there's all this dancing around that. And it just keeps going. I mean, it's almost like on an explicit level and an implicit level, subliminally as well as consciously, you want to get that message.
Absolutely. It for me, it always goes back, and this too is Youth Speaks ethos. It always goes back to the 10th grade classroom for me. And finding as many different points of access through centralized questions as possible. This is Frarian pedagogy at work for sure. And it has kind of circulated in the 15-year history of Youth Speaks, not only through our workshop series, but also in the performance that we do. And so how do we create as many different points as possible to content? What are the questions and what are the media that we might use to give folks an avenue in? And by kind of multiplying these avenues rather than just giving one straight shot, we find that there's kind of a collective experience that's also maximized in the moment. And I have a background in dance.
You've been performing your whole life pretty much.
I have been pretty much since I was 5 years old, give or take. A lot of on the soccer field as well, I got to say.
I know that you had that in your bona fides as a soccer player as well, really.
Yeah, ask Daniel Alarcón about my soccer skills.
I'll make a mental note of that.
Please do.
We're talking with Mark Mahmoudi Joseph, Artistic Director of Youth Speaks, and one of our first-person profiles. Let me open the phone lines, and those of you who have seen Mahmoudi perform, or those of you who heard him here today and want to join the conversation, if you have questions or comments, please feel free to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you, and it's toll-free whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and again, please feel free to join the conversation. 866-733-6786. We want to talk also about just how stories are told and the whole notion of whether they come across with greater effect when they come across, let's say, through slam poetry or through dance and music and all of the multimedia that really has been sort of the genre identified with our guest, Mark Mahmoudi Joseph. Again, toll free, you can join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And if you'd like to become a part of the conversation, you can also do that by going to our Facebook page. When we return, we'll bring you into the conversation. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Mark Mahmoudi Joseph, who is, of course, a poet and dancer and artistic director of Youth Speaks, and has a new production over at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, Red, Black, and Green. Just talking off air about his background a bit, which I want to get into, but also about Colson Whitehead. And I'm going to be interviewing him at the Herbst Theater coming up a week from tonight, as part of the City Arts and Lecture Series. Why are you such a big fan of Colson Whitehead?
Oh, man, I just think, the intuitionist, Apex Hides the Hurt, John Henry days, these are just some of my favorite novels. I would say he and Edwidge Danticat and Percival Everett, those are my three favorite contemporary novelists. But Colson Whitehead in particular, you know, he's so glib. He's so funny. And, you know, all the textures of his work are so compelling. You know, The Intuitionist is kind of the big deal book, but there's a smaller tome called the Colossus of New York that I really appreciate. I think it's spelled out, or it's compartmentalized in maybe 11 different sections. And being from New York, being from Queens, what I really relate to in that piece is the transiency of the city, and particularly our relationship to the city. The city keeps moving, but we always want to kind of keep it in the place that you know, that is most romantic and most nostalgic to us. And he does such a great job of kind of traversing that tension between the city that keeps moving and the home that we want to keep still.
Well, you've read his essays on New York too, that collection that was, put out. And he talks about that mobility. I hope some people will show up for this on Tuesday.
No, I hope so.
Because he's for people like us, he's someone who's really, really, his literary talents are obviously appreciated. Mm-hmm. We're going to get our callers in here, but you mentioned Edwidge Danicad because, like you, she's Haitian-American.
Yes.
Comes from Haitian background.
Yeah.
And, really, how close are you to that tradition or that lineage in your work and your mind and your consciousness?
Well, definitely in my consciousness and my blood memory. I'm first generation American. I'm the first in my family born here in the United States. My grandmother recently passed. She was 95. And I'm acutely aware of the passing of my lineage as a result. She was the lion in our family. And when we lost her, we lost so much of kind of the physical matter of memory in our culture and in our tradition. And, you know, me, first generation born in the United States, now moves to California. I have a biracial son who's Taiwanese and, you know, and Haitian. And so I'm watching my family become increasingly American.
Yeah. Before we go to calls here, you got to talk about your Thanksgiving dinner, because I think that's so classic and so unbelievable. Who was there in this extended family of yours?
Well, I had Thanksgiving with my fiance and her daughter and my son and my son's mom and my son's mom's fiance and my roommate and his girlfriend and his three kids and his parents and his kid's mom and his kid's mom's boyfriend all around the table. Folks ask me, do I raise my son on my own? And I don't. You know, I'm not married to his mom, but our family is so deep and so broad and so diverse. And though I just named the, I don't know, 50 or so folks that were around my Thanksgiving table, we do believe in raising our children in village, which is why I can talk about Jeff Chang's kid being on the baseball team. And I can talk about Hadari Davis and, you know, and his kids, you know, pretty much raising my son as well. So my new American family.
Indeed. And let me bring on some callers here. Max is first up. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call and for a very good program. In part, you've already answered my question. I wanted to Mr. Joseph to explore how his Haitian background has influenced his art. So I'll stop here, and I'll listen to the answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Well, of course, people often associate Haiti, maybe even too much so, with voodoo and Marie Laveau and all that. Kind of. Does that play in at all to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the spiritual traditions, the ways that the divine is made. Is made both physical and ethereal in different forms, definitely plays a part in my consciousness. You know, we've been talking about hybridity, and I'd like to think that there is some link between the many different avenues that I explore in my art and this constellation of the divine. I'm profoundly influenced by Maya Deren and her work. One of my favorite choreographers is Adia Whitaker, who is steeped in Haitian traditions. And then I would also say that the, you know, the series that Edwidge just edited, the Haïti Noir series, you know, has been profoundly impactful. And then I created a whole work called Scourge in 2004 and 2005 that was about the process of my family becoming American and also searching through song and text and music, different ways that the Haitian American experience is revolutionized in the United States of America through my body.
Well, here's a question, actually a comment on the web. Listener writes, I saw MBJ's new production last week. It took my breath away, and hearing his words on the radio brings tears to my eyes. Again, as a West Oakland resident, artist, mixed-race mother of a white-appearing child, I am concerned with how the linguistic metaphors of race terminology. Can you address the language, how one identifies as self as color, as black, white, brown, etc.? So you talk about your brown child, for example. And
I do.
Yeah.
I do, yeah.
And you want hybridization and, you know, all this diversity and so forth, but people do see in colors. You know?
Yeah, we do. I mean, you know, there's no eliminating or avoiding our temporal reality. There's no avoiding experience. And, you know, it's this question, you know, when I directed Shanaka Hodges' play last year at Intersection for the Arts, it's called Mirrors in Every Corner. The cornerstone of the piece was about a black family that had whose youngest child was a white girl. Mm-hmm. And the white girl never appeared on stage. It was performed by, you know, five black actors, including Tracy Tolmere, who's in Red, Black, and Green. And so there were all these questions about how you, you know, how you give life to a colored body that's not there, and how you complicate race in these challenging and poetic ways by introducing a specter, a ghost, a young girl who actually in her white body has a blood memory of being hung, of being lynched. And, you know, race is complicated, particularly in the 21st century, particularly in the Bay Area. And
well, you say, in fact, about your boy, mm-hmm. about your son, in one of your videos, he's a brown baby and he's mm-hmm. born with three strikes against him. You mm-hmm. believe that to be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are all these economic factors, I think, that are kind of channeling class into and complicating the racial equation with kind of a newfound urgency around class and economics. And this is something that, you know, you spoke about earlier. You know, we have these algorithms to connect our various economies, you know, on a global scale. We don't have such algorithms to really chart the impact of environment or the impact of, you know, the criminal justice system on race. We have statistics, but we don't have these kind of psychic algorithms to really chart out and really articulate the dangers that young men of color face. And so, yeah, we see in color. It's hard to escape. I don't wish to oversimplify or undercomplicate, you know, the lexicon of race. I just seek to make art and in that way make us all a little bit more whole.
Well, here's a listener who writes, hi, Michael. I saw Bamu's called Bamu too, huh?
Yeah.
Bamu's performance last week and was blown away. I'm an acquaintance and a fellow poet. What I liked most was the focus on respect for life, all individual life. Most poignant were the scenes of Mark talking to his son, bequeathing him African-American history and so much more. Mm-hmm. The seed is carried into the future with such tenderness. What I got out of the whole piece was so much love. Love born of suffering and knowledge. Best wishes to Mark. And that's someone named Ravi.
So, hey, thanks, Ravi.
We'll go to a caller in Larkspur. Mo, hi, you're on.
Hi, I actually know Mark. Mark, it's Mo Clancy.
Hey!
How are you?
I just,
you know, I've been, I have more of a comment than anything. I've been witness to Mark's work and to his devotion to cultivating storytelling within the next generation through Youth Speaks. And I just wanted to comment just how important storytelling is and how, you know, important Mark Bamudi is to the Bay Area and to carrying on this tradition that has become sort of lost in our culture. It's something that James Cass, the founder of Youth Speaks, always says, that words matter. And I think that Mark epitomizes that and is just a treasure to the Bay Area scene. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Well, a good comment indeed. Thank you. And it's the griot again, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, for sure. You know, there's this kind of rabid anti-intellectualism, I think, in our current political discourse. And accompanying that anti-intellectualism is a lack of respect for easy conversation and narrative. And what I love about the work that we do at Youth Speaks is, you know, the way that we provide young leaders places, you know, safe spaces to conduct themselves in a way that promotes soft narrative and easy conversation, as well as, you know, highly polemical, poetic work. And I think that our politics will advance if we find ourselves somewhere in the middle or somewhere between the two, rather than, you know, the kind of polarized ethics that that we currently have in our discourse.
And well, so, many people don't associate hip hop and that kind of tradition with softness and tenderness. And unfortunately, there's certainly a lot of it, but mm-hmm. they tend to think about the gangster rap and all that. And it needs to be seen as a whole continuum. I think Jeff Chang has made this case many times, mm-hmm. you know, that there's a wide spectrum, really.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if all I did, you know, if you came to the United States and you just watched MTV and that was the only channel that you watched, you know, like you'd have a Jersey Shore version, you know, of the United States. And we know that the country is much more diverse and much deeper than that. So if your entire perception of hip hop culture comes from corporate radio, then you're going to have an illegitimate reflection and idea of the power of the culture. The fact is, I'm 35 years old. I was born in 1975 in New York, the same place and the same time that hip hop was born. The voice that you're listening to is of hip hop culture, you know? So as long as we're in the business of moving out of kind of a monolithic perception of what this country can be and what the foundation of this country is, I think that we also have to take into account that hip hop culture is the reason why the president of the United States is Barack Obama, right? The younger generation overwhelmingly sided with Obama in the 2008 election. This portion of the electorate that was undervalued and dismissed. And so there is activation, there is culinary skill, there is political acumen, there is tender parenting love, and there is theater. And I'm representative of all of that and hip hop.
And again, our guest is Mark Bermudi. Joseph, and if you'd like to join the program, by the way, in the time remaining, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. And let's get Robbie on from Oakland. Robbie, welcome.
Hi. I'm a big fan of Colson Whitehead, too, just to put in a pitch for him. I do hope you get a good audience. He's just an amazing writer, and I think he's one of the best in the country right now. But on another subject, I have hoped to get over to see your show in at Yerba Buena, and I know I can't make it this week. Is there a venue in the East Bay where you're going to be able to perform this piece?
No, you know, the next piece that comes to the East Bay is called Word Becomes Flesh. It'll be there in February of 2012, one night, a co-production with La Peña Cultural Center. And Word Becomes Flesh is the first piece that I wrote. It was initially a solo piece, but through an NEA grant, we were able to reconfigure the work as a multiplayer work, and it's currently touring throughout the country. The next, we have three nights at Yerba Buena Center this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And then after that, the piece goes on tour to, I think, 12 cities across the United States. The closest that will be to the Bay Area, I think, is Seattle. And that's in late May or June of 2012. And then if we're lucky, the piece will come back around, you know, perhaps to Stanford, or, you know, maybe as far away as Los Angeles. But three nights, that's what we got.
That's it. Sorry that it's not going to be out there with you in the East Bay, Bobby, but thank you for calling. Let's go back to your roots and your background. You came out here from New York at age
21.
Yeah, so you were just in your majority. What brought you out here?
I got a teaching fellowship at the Branson School in Ross, California. I had just graduated from Morehouse. I thought that I was just going to live in Atlanta and throw parties. I was really good at it, you know. And
Branson School is a pretty Tony school.
It is a pretty Tony school. It's true.
So how was that? Was that a little cultural adjustment? Or?
Yeah, you know, yes and no. Yeah, I went to the Dalton School in New York City. So
say no more.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with Tony schools, you know, Upper East Side version. And then I went to Morehouse College, which is all black, all male in the South, in, you know, in Atlanta, Georgia. And so I came kind of plucked out of the water, you know, or out of the red clay at Morehouse and landed in Marin. And, you know, at 21, I had no teaching skills, but I had a lot of charisma and I just read all the books. You know what I mean? You know, that time when you're like right out of undergrad or right out of graduate school and you've just read everything. So, you know, everything. So, man, I had charisma and energy and closeness.
And 14 years later, you realize how little you know, right?
Exactly. It didn't even take 14 years. It probably took 14 minutes, but I had a good time there. And, you know, it's funny.
You were there how long?
I was there 2 years. And 2 years into my tenure at Branson, I met James Cass. And we went to the former Yugoslavia together. We went to Bosnia together and spent time in Mostar with two of our mentees. And that summer of 1999, which was the same summer that I won the National Poetry Slam, we decided to work together. And I think really took Youth Speaks to another level at that point.
What did winning the Poetry Slam bring? I mean, in the way of recognition and plaudits and accolades and all that? What in addition?
What was great about winning the National Poetry Slam at the time was that there was no deaf poetry, so there really wasn't anywhere else to go as a performance poet, at least, you know, that I knew of. I was 23, and I didn't know what else to do inside of the Poetry Slam. At the time, there weren't really folks that were touring colleges or lecturing, so I didn't really know what the economy was around performing poetry across the country. And so what that did for me artistically was it brought me out from behind the microphone and kind of the 3-minute time limit that is imposed upon us in the Poetry Slam. And that's when I started extending my verse work and incorporating my body more. So winning the Poetry Slam wasn't the greatest in terms of kind of my personal economy or my career trajectory.
It didn't necessarily launch you, really.
No, but it did launch me artistically in a different place.
Moved you into a different avatar?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And returned me, actually, to my theatrical roots. But now I was able to integrate some of the Poetry Slam ethic into the theater that I was making. And so it, in a lot of ways, was the best possible thing that could have happened for me in my artistic development at that time.
We just did a show recently on all the poetry as performance and all of the, literature as performance, stories as performance. I mean, it's continued to burgeon and exponentially burgeon. What do you say, though, to the old school types? I have some of this in my blood, too, mm-hmm. You know, say, well, it's, you know, we should be reading Emily Dickinson and T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden and Yeats and so forth, mm-hmm. that there's more of a split because of what we have as the text as opposed to now what we have as performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I don't believe in any one thing.
You want hybridization?
Well, I want a food court. You know, I just don't want to have fries every meal. You know, I want a little bit of diversity in my life. I want a little bit of, you know, flavor in my coffee. And so, this outstanding canon, you know, local, national, and international poets. Yes. Should we be steeped in that tradition? Yes. Should we acknowledge our history and the canon? Yes, absolutely. Will we all perish if we stop writing because we're stuck in one singular place? Yeah. It kind of goes back to this notion of future folklore. What do you take? How do you root yourself in a legacy and in a history and give homage to that and simultaneously move the tradition forward? You know, it's a question that we have to ask ourselves. Now, if all you do is use your body and, vocalize at high decibels with no relationship to character or texture or the depth of language, then yeah, you're doing everyone a disservice. And I think paying attention solely to corporate hip hop, there are folks that have only seen bad performance poets.
That's the second time you talked about corporate radio before. Now, corporate hip-hop, there's
for sure
an animus there. Would that be fair to say?
It would be fair to say.
Want to extrapolate on that a bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, folks say to me, you know, a lot. Well, you know what? I'll take myself out of the equation. There's this... There are a number of MCs and rappers and hip hop artists that I love. You know, I love Lupe Fiasco, you know, but just, you know, there's this crew, the Get Back crew that I love. There's this crew, Zion I, that I love, Rico Pabon, the list goes on and on. And I am personally offended by how segmented the culture is in the public imagination through the perpetuation of the corporate interest of pushing sex, violence, drugs, and capitalism onto our youth. I'm personally offended because I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old stepdaughter, and this is the dominant music in the mainstream. And I would like to think that there is greater space on our airwaves, both in radio and television, for the full spectrum of what this culture has to offer.
But you know the corporate argument. We're giving them what they want. This is in the marketplace.
Well, they think they want it because that's what you're giving them.
A chicken or egg.
If all you give me is Kool-Aid, then, you know, I'm like, wow, this Kool-Aid is great. You know what I mean? Let me have some grapefruit juice, too.
Let's see what we're getting. Web comments. Michael, thanks for the great interview and introduction, Mr. Joseph. This is a great conversation. Thank you for that. Here's another comment on the web. I want to comment on how wonderful of an instructor Bamudi is. I had the good fortune of taking a performance poetry class at Mills with him. Mark does a good job of sharing the legacy of storytelling, giving us storytellers new ways to think about this craft. Can you speak about what fuels your teaching methods and inspires your vision for the next generation of storytellers? Thank you for sharing your talent with students. Mm-hmm. Well, you've kind of really touched on that already, but anything to add?
Yeah, I would just say that kind of the populist ethos in education, really as kind of codified, I think, most brilliantly by Paulo Freire, continues to be the foundation of my pedagogical work. The notion of making safe space for culture as well is something that I try to introduce into the classroom. And it also kind of carries forth inside of the performance space. You know, I think what makes the show at Yerba Buena Center so potent is that it's immediately made safe for collective discussion and collective emotional response. I think that's the best way to operate
the audience.
A classroom.
I mean,
apparently.
It's that spontaneity of impact of the audience that you have. Somebody writes, just watched your video above and was struck by the line when you talk about the color brown invoking a connection to the fertile earth, and then see how dark the day becomes when you bury the light. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the world black, beautiful and so illuminating, writes this
Thank
listener.
You.
Actually, you know Richard Rodriguez's book, Brown? I mean, all about the idea of being brown.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. It's more identified with Hispanic mm-hmm. identity for him. But mm-hmm. with you, it's your son is brown.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so am I.
Yeah. Another web comment. I'm a student and involved in many movements on my campus, including social justice and environmentalism. I'm exposed to many art forms on my campus, including spoken word, rap, and instrumental pieces. I see many of my friends work toward their causes through community organizing and academic studies, but I feel like art is undervalued as a method of activism and seen more as recreational. I want to ask how we as young students can once again connect art and solving many issues that we face today.
Yeah, I think the key word there is value. And where we place our values socially, academically, and within the movement. I think that what most folks might agree upon is that the creative intellect is most responsible for the branding of any idea, whether it's the KQED logo or the Coca-Cola swoosh or, you know, the commercials that are on, are on television, right? All these ideas are funneled through the through an artistic lens and the artistic imagination. And so in that way, we do value art. The thing is, when the art is infused with a less kind of superficial intention, then it becomes a matter of personal taste and aesthetic, you know, whether we value it or not. And so what I would urge your listener to do is to keep making the argument for the depth of art as a valuable and national resource. You know, the art economy is billions and billions of dollars strong. I just don't think that we recognize the artistic manifestations of the creative intellect as readily as we do the corporate manifestations of the artistic intellect, in the same way that the sustainable survival practices inside of African America aren't necessarily codified in an environmental way, the way that they probably justifiably should be. So keep pushing for new definitions of value.
There's mentor, teacher, poet, dancer, performer, Mark Mooney Joseph, giving some final advice to young people. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And New York had you for 21 years, but we're glad we have you now.
Right on.
We'll be back with you on tomorrow. In fact, in this hour tomorrow, we're going to talk with a great translator, Stephen Mitchell, who has a new version of the Iliad out. Thank you for being part of today's program. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.